plots were unrecognizable. The whole landscape has changed.
Melting sea ice transforms Alaska's interior vegetation. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a legend in salvage operations sells his business.
You have the competition, and then you have the increase in magnitude of the response needs, and the combination of those, I just couldn't ante up to that level.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by Enroll Alaska, helping educate and enroll Alaskans in health insurance under the federal mandate created by the Affordable Care Act. Learn more at enrollingalaska.com.
The Arctic sea ice has been surprising scientists for the last 6 years. It set a new record for melting back during the International Polar Year in 2007. Last year, it beat that record. But at the same time, the seasonal ice in the Bering Sea has been increasing, also to a record last winter. And as APRN Steve Heimel reports, whatever is driving these changes is also beginning to affect the vegetation on land.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks Institute of Arctic Biology set up a series of test plots along the Dalton Highway and north for the International Polar Year, hopping islands into the Canadian Arctic. This summer, permafrost researcher Vladimir Romanovsky went out to check them. The line of plots ends at Elif Rignis Island, less than 10 degrees below the North Pole. UAF biologist Skip Walker could hardly believe what Romanovsky sent back.
So he revisited the site and sent us pictures back of our plots, and they were unrecognizable. The whole landscape has changed.
What Romanovsky saw and what will be reported at a scientific meeting in December is permafrost melting and slumping in a place that is normally frozen year-round. The sea ice was not sufficient this summer to keep the air above the test plots from warming up. What that means for a whole category of plant life on land that needs year-round sea ice to exist is largely a matter of speculation. Skip Walker is one of the authors of a report published last month in Science magazine that seeks to survey the impacts on land of less ice in the sea. He says the picture's not going to be as simple as less ice leading to more warmth and more vegetation. Satellite imagery that can basically read the amount of plant material on the ground is not showing such a simple response, and temperatures in some areas are for some reason no longer continuing to rise as more sea ice is lost.
Temperatures have been going up, but recently there seems to be a more heterogeneous pattern. We're seeing some areas of the Arctic that are continue to warm very quickly and dramatically, and then other areas, mainly in Eurasia, that are we're not seeing that trend. It's either flat or actually declining in some areas. And we're seeing the same thing with the biomass response.
It's a big mystery right now. UAF atmospheric scientist Uma Bhatt is another co-author of the article. She and Walker are seeing reduced vegetation, greenness, and more brownness. Along with Russia, it's happening along the Alaska coast of the Bering Sea.
There seems to be a decline in greening. And there's been a decline in warming in the summer. And we think it's related to cloudiness, but that's our next paper to figure that out.
Both collaborators have noticed that the browning correlates with the way the sea ice has been disappearing from the Bering Sea later in recent years.
So the vegetation has not become more productive in that area, but we don't know if it's related to the sea ice because the sea ice is gone before things green up in that part because it's so far south.
For more than a dozen years now, nearly all the changes hitting the Arctic due to reduced sea ice have added up to warming effects exceeding anything the computer models have predicted. The warming has fed more warming as positive feedbacks have been stronger than predicted. Warmer water circulating under the ice, more heat stored by increased vegetative growth, and a darker ocean, all feeding yet more warming. But the browning begins to look like a negative feedback. And Bhatt says some recently observed changes in sea ice do too.
And I think one of the things that's coming out of some of the meteorology work is as you take sea ice away, when you take a little bit away, you have one response, things warm up. But when you take more away, it might change the circulation totally, and it may not keep warming. And there's some new studies that are suggesting that it's not a linear thing. It changes.
It's all frontier science. New observations demanding new theoretical explanations. The negative feedbacks, while intriguing, remain greatly outweighed by the positive ones, and no doubt they complicate things yet more for the computer modelers, giving them new material to try to integrate. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
After 40 years in Western Alaska, salvager Dan McGone is selling his namesake diving and marine rescue business. But as KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, McGone will still be there to help when disaster strikes.
McGone says he's been kicking around the idea of selling for a long time. Then a new tide of Coast Guard vessel safety rules came along.
We're having so much trouble with the keeping up with the regulations.
McGone says he spent millions of dollars trying to get his response vessels up to code. In the meantime, more companies started to show up in Alaska to do salvage and rescue.
You have the competition, and then you have the increase in magnitude of the response needs, and the combination of those, I just couldn't ante up to that level. So that's the reason that I'm, merging with Resolve.
That's Resolve Marine Group. They're a salvage and oil spill response company based out of Fort Lauderdale. They worked on the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010, and they helped clean up New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. McGone won't say how much Resolve paid him, and Todd Duke, a project manager for Resolve who's been sent out to Unalaska, says the company's still working out the details of the acquisition.
Quite frankly, we are still developing our plan. We don't expect anything to change much.
Resolve has plenty of international salvage experience, but relatively little in Alaska. That's why they're keeping McGone in charge of the shop in Unalaska until the 61-year-old wants to retire. Beyond that, Duke says the biggest shift is in the maritime resources that will be staged here. Resolve has already sent a barge, a crane, and an ice-class anchor-handling rescue tug to join McGone's fleet in Unalaska.
We're making the area better because we brought some assets that are different than the assets that are currently here.
They'll be put to use over the next week when the Resolve crew joins McGone Marine in Dillingham to work on the salvage of the fishing vessel Lone Star. The vessel's been stuck at the bottom of the Agushik River for 2 months, but the Lone Star is a small job compared to the bulk freighters, ship fires, and large-scale oil spills that McGone's tackled over the years. For his new partner, though, it might be a good look at what Alaska has in store. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
A helicopter, its pilot, and two researchers are still stuck near the top of 7,100-foot Mount McGeek in Katmai National Park and Preserve. They've been there since Wednesday evening. A freezing rainstorm grounded the helicopter as the researchers were attempting to recover volcano monitoring equipment. The helicopter belongs to Igley Air Hall out of King Salmon and was piloted by Sam Igley, the company's president. The three have remained in radio contact with authorities and are reportedly well-equipped to stay put on the mountain for the time being. The Alaska State Troopers in King Salmon were first notified about the helicopter shortly after 6 p.m. on Wednesday, but were unable to launch a rescue operation because of poor weather. The Air National Guard flew an unsuccessful rescue attempt Thursday evening and were expected to continue trying today. Winds will not be significant for South Central Alaska this weekend, but rain is hammering the Valdez and Cordova area. National Weather Service meteorologist Sean Bain says rain is falling at a rate up to a quarter inch per hour. He says that is creating concern for small streams that feed rivers.
6 to 10 inches of water on the Richardson Highway at about mile 6.5. So the low river, which flows right along there, is moving onto the road, and they have done some work putting an earthen berm right along there to try and block some of the water, but I guess that's only helping a little bit. So that sort of flooding is just a little bit of overflow from smaller streams as the water continues or the rain continues to fall.
Bain says today's rain accumulation in the Mat-Su Valley has not been significant, and there are no flood concerns. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new training program in Sitka to help people recognize and address domestic violence.
I think we have reached now the step where we as a community can step up and say we can make a difference.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Federal Subsistence Board is seeking ideas to improve the rural determination process. Only Alaska residents living in rural areas or communities are eligible to harvest fish and wildlife resources on federal public lands under federal subsistence regulations. The deadline to submit your ideas is November the 1st. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The world's largest cruise corporation will soon install new pollution control equipment on 32 of its ships. Carnival, Princess, and Holland America vessels sailing Alaska waters are likely to be among those getting the gear. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Carnival Corporation owns 10 cruise lines operating about 100 ships from ports in North America, Europe, Australia, and New Zealand. It's a significant player in the Alaska market. Corporate officials say the technology, called scrubbing, will meet new international requirements for sulfur and smoke emissions. They say they'll spend about $180 million on the equipment over the next 2 to 3 years.
Well, we haven't determined which ships of the 32 will be implemented in what markets and what ports.
Roger Frizzell is a spokesman for Carnival, which is headquartered in Miami and London. He spoke from the Fort Lauderdale, Florida, airport.
Alaska is obviously an important market, and I'm expecting that if they don't have it right away, they will have it shortly.
The equipment has been tested on one ship's diesel engine so far. The evidence helped win conditional approval from the Federal Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Coast Guard. Frizzell says Carnival eventually plans to use scrubbing on all of its 102 vessels.
This is going to be a real change in our industry, and I think it's something that for Alaska and other key ports is going to be beneficial to their environmental area.
Carnival scrubbers target sulfur oxides, which contribute to global warming and acid rain. They also remove soot and other small particles that make up ships' exhaust. Frizzell says the technology is common on shore.
This is the first time this combination is being developed to accommodate restricted spaces on ships.
Did that require a significant re-engineering of the technology?
It did. When we moved it from the power plants and factories to the ship, it really was a complete overhaul of the existing systems and resizing.
I think there's just been a whole shift at Carnival with all the problems they've had and everything.
Industry critic Chip Toma of Juno says the corporation is making a significant and welcome change. But the president of the group responsible cruising in Alaska says it's not all good intentions.
They're making so much money. It's such a lucrative corporation. They've decided to switch gears and get into the 21st century, and it's a wonderful move that they've done so.
The EPA says the agreement is a trial effort, and the technology will be closely monitored. Carnival spokesman Frizzell says it exempts equipped ships from new, stronger air quality regulations aimed at lowering pollution along the coast.
The exemption gives us the flexibility to choose whatever fuel source we determine, and that's significant for us because it gives us an economic value.
That's because low sulfur fuel is more expensive than what cruise ships usually burn. The agreement still requires Carnival ships to use that fuel while in port, or plug into an onshore power source, as is done in Juneau. The EPA has also reached agreements with Royal Caribbean and Norwegian cruise lines, as well as barge companies and owners of some other large vessels. Some are using different approaches. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
The clinic for Juneau's homeless and low-income residents will stay open at least through April 30th, thanks to the fundraising efforts of local community members and organizations. The Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium recently announced plans to close Front Street Clinic on October 1st due to budgetary constraints. More than $100,000 was raised in the past week. Maria Lovichuk is executive director of Glory Hole, Juneau's soup kitchen and shelter.
It was kind of like one of the sort of like most clear things I've ever had to do in my life. You know, like you have to call like everybody you know and like you have to ask them all for money and you have to just very honestly explain what you're asking for. And because what I was asking for is just like so rudimentary, people gave money.
COO Dan Neumeister says Surge will use $90,000 from a U.S. Health Resources and Services Administration grant to run the clinic. Total costs to keep Front Street open an additional 6 months are about $250,000. Neumeister says the shortfall will be covered by community fundraising. The domestic violence shelter in Sitka is stepping up its community training program following the release of new survey data last year. SAFE, or Sitkins Against Family Violence, has routinely offered volunteer training, but now the organization is hoping to involve more of the community in how to recognize and address Sitka's incredibly high rate of intimate partner violence. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The numbers are staggering. According to the 2012 Alaska Victimization Survey, almost half of all women living in Sitka have experienced intimate partner violence, sexual violence, or both.
This is actually a surprise.
Martina Kurzer is the community coordinator for Sitkins Against Family Violence.
Not only for us, but particularly for those who are not really steeped in the issue.
282 adult women in Sitka were surveyed last year by researchers at the University of Alaska Anchorage's Justice Center. It was part of an ongoing statewide effort by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Kurzer says SAFE's training is being offered this year not just to shelter volunteers, but to the entire community, free of charge. While the victimization survey quantifies the significant amount of physical violence experienced by women, and the threat of physical violence, Kurzer says the training is designed to break down our assumptions.
It's not battering, because that's a very, very limited definition, and we will define this term because there are other terms. If somebody always puts down somebody else, that's in a household, that's also a violent act, emotional or verbal, but we consider that violent.
Other common assumptions, Kurzer says, are that women will want to leave a relationship if they experience violence, or that there is no love in a violent relationship. She says the training helps participants see why both may be untrue.
Many of these assumptions just fall apart if you go through this, and then you have this, suddenly you start understanding what's going on next door. And also, you learn what to do when you witness something that happens next door.
SAFE uses a combination of shelter staff and local professionals to teach the sessions, which take place over 3 Saturdays and 3 Monday evenings. Participants can drop in on any or all of the sessions. Kurzer says there is no one who would not benefit from the training. Anyone who has colleagues, coworkers, patients, or students will understand them better and become more compassionate.
I think we have reached now the step where we as a community can step up and say we can make a difference.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, preservation. In June, the KQ Cannery in Cake was named one of the 11 most endangered historic places in the country by the National Trust for Historic Preservation. The building is an artifact of Alaska's salmon canning industry, and it's a reminder of the different people that worked there. KCAW's Eric Newman visited Cake's cannery to learn why it needs help.
The heartbeat of the communities surrounded the operations of the cannery back in its heyday.
That's Gary Williams. He's the executive director of the Organized Village of Cake, the town's tribal government. We're standing in front of the KQ Cannery. It's a series of buildings propped up on pilings. In front are the tide flats in KQ Strait on the northern edge of Kuprinoff Island. The cannery is a complex of huge pale green warehouses and little outbuildings. There are houses where the workers live and boardwalks connecting them all together.
Should we go check out the cannery?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay.
Yeah. As long as you promise not to jump around.
Yeah.
And I will point out in that area there's some asbestos. So.
The cannery is vast and filled with big pieces of machinery. Inside there are conveyor belts and funnels where cans move through the plant.
But yeah, see these over here was called the retorts, which were essentially gigantic pressure cookers where the canned fish was put in that for the sealing process, cooking and sealing.
In June, the cannery was named one of America's most endangered historic places. The decision came from the National Trust for Historic Preservation. It was already a National Historic Landmark, a designation it got in 1997. Unlike the Historic Register, which is usually for houses, landmark designations are reserved for big things. Also on the endangered list this year was the Houston Astrodome, a section of Virginia's James River, and a lighthouse in Massachusetts. Basically, naming it an endangered historic place means it's nationally important and it needs attention, urgently.
It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when this building falls over.
That's Rob Meinhardt. He's the owner of True North Development Solutions. They're a historic preservation firm that created a plan to stabilize the cannery, so hopefully it doesn't fall over. He says the KQ cannery is important because it's a good example of the cannery industry in the nation as a whole, but even more so because of the way it shows the labor practices in the industry.
You would have the Filipinos staying in this bunkhouse over here, fulfilling these sort of roles within the cannery. You would have the Japanese population over here. You would have the Tlingit population, the Alaska Native population over here, staying in these houses over here. It's a highly segregated business operation.
Gary Williams and the tribe want to tell this old story of the cannery business, but they also want to make it usable so it can be part of Cake's economy again.
One thing I've learned in working with the historic preservation world is making a quote-unquote adaptive reuse is one of the goals, so that the building is utilized and not just sitting dormant.
William says the restored building could be an opportunity for cultural heritage tourism, and he lists examples like a performance space for the Kaekwon dancers and shops for local merchants and craftsmen.
Taking a peek here into the main cannery building, and certainly more than one person suggested, too, that areas of this building could be used as a museum area as well, because there's old equipment, the old machine shop.
But that's a long way off. Getting the endangered designation doesn't come with any money. William says the estimate for the initial stabilization would be $500,000, and that it would cost millions to restore the cannery. Again, here's Rob Meinhardt, the planner.
The pilings have undergone severe rot. So basically, this huge structure, cannery structure that's sitting over the pilings, is basically sitting on hollow pilings. It's really kind of scary.
In the years since the cannery got its initial historic landmark status, two buildings in the complex have collapsed. The last one was during a particularly bad windstorm 3 years ago. But Meinhardt says the residents of Cake have a reputation for being a very determined group of people. And he believes with their track record and the effort they're putting in, there's hope the cannery can be saved. Reporting in Cake, I'm Eric Newman.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're heading to Nelson Lagoon, a tiny fishing community on the Bering Sea side of the Alaska Peninsula.
My name is Justine Gunderson. I'm the administrator for the Nelson Lagoon Tribal Council. It's a village, primarily Aleut. We live on kind of a sand spit between the Nelson Lagoon and the Bering Sea. There's about 65 or so, maybe 68 population. We have no school. It closed last year, or the year before, actually. So we have three kids here that are being homeschooled. Well, it was very tough. You know, once you close a school, you're kind of going to lose a lot of people in the community. We did lose a family here. We went into Anchorage. So it does affect the community a lot. Most everyone here fishes. The commercial fishing for salmon is just about to end. We sell to Peter Pan Seafoods, and they're going to be closing up because the silver run hasn't been very good here.
We have not had very good years in the last 3 to 4 years. And actually, this is the first year for Reds that we've had any kind of indication that we had a great run. The previous years had been dismal. But again, we've had a good, strong run this year. But the silvers aren't strong. The fish plant we have here, it hasn't been operating. It was built by APICTA, our CDQ group. Hopefully, it will be in production next year for possibly flying fish out. And that might bring workers in and maybe families in. I'm not sure, but we're kind of hoping to change the population around in Nelson Lagoon. Gorgeous on a nice day. Today it's overcast, but we've got the mountains, of course. We're surrounded by water, and in the summer it looks like an emerald here. It's just beautiful, green. Lots of activity. In the winter, there's snow machining, ice fishing, and of course in the summer it's consumed by, you know, commercial fishing. So maybe that doesn't sound interesting to a lot of people, but it is a lot of fun.
Justine Gunderson is the administrator for the Nelson Lagoon Tribal Council. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Eric Newman and Annie Fite. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Ed Schoenfeld and Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. Parents, encourage your kids to participate in the Healthy Futures Challenge at their school. It's free and a lot of fun. All your kids need to do is be active each week and keep a log of their physical activities. They'll feel great and get cool prizes, too. Go to playeveryday.alaska.gov to find out if your child's elementary school is participating. And parents, why not get out and play every day with your kids? It's great for the whole family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.